ordinary. Every word he spoke was drawn from a deep well of generosity. He had built it up, fed it to the brim, over decades of contemplating people. And whatever their defects or defenses or eccentricities, however unappetizing they might be personally or morally, loving them without reserve. His gentle power sprang from a straightforward assessment of the world and his job in it. That job was love. There was morning mass in the crypt of the abbey, the dawn's orange-golden glimmer edging through the slit windows. The crypt of my first day's nightmares was in reality a place of sacral mystery, a catacomb, Merlin's cave become Christian, a cavern measureless to man. In the gold-tinged gloom were other priests at other altars, each lit by his two candles, whispering his mass. I knelt behind Father Joe as he said his, quite resplendent in a white and red chasuble, the only time he actually looked like a member of the Catholic clergy, but transfigured. His eyes closed for almost the entire time. Every Latin word, even those that changed every day, known by heart, relished through his smiling lips, pursing and unpursing, as if he were savoring sips of wine. By my second or third visit, I was beginning to get to know other monks as well. My initial impression of uniformity, even anonymity, was quite incorrect. They came from all over the map. A suave and worldly chain-smoking ex-banker from Vienna, reputed by the Catholics to be a Jewish convert, an ageless, irrepressible midget from Malta, with skin the color of conkers, visiting Italians, a German or two, Frenchman galore, a huge, tall, paunchy monk with a very pucker accent, who looked like an ex-cabinet minister in a witness protection program, and was always dashing off to London on mysterious missions involving Jesuits and cardinals. The second Easter, my anniversary, I spent my entire 2-week school vacation at Cor, and Father Joe began to let me hover on the fringes of actual monastic life. Nothing was more central to it, he believed, than the lay brothers. Lay brothers were an anachronism, even in the 1950s, defined as those for whom long church offices were not appropriate, whose talents lay in more practical directions, they did not take priestly orders. Hence they were brothers, not fathers. Most of the surviving lay brothers were French, and by now very old, having entered the order as teens in the late 19th century and come over with the community when religious orders were expelled from France in the early 20th. Every monk capable of it performed manual labor, but the majority, who were priests, divided their time between manual work and other more intellectual pursuits. They were scholars, musicologists, skilled craftsmen, etc., while the brothers worked mostly at menial tasks. Father Joe, who had been master of the lay brothers, especially loved the old men, believing them to be saints, though he made relentless fun of their peasanty Norman and Breton accents. And when I begged him to give me some laborare I could orare to, put me in charge of Frère Louis, the woodsman. Frère Louis was 75 or 85. He said he couldn't remember, and certainly no one else could. He was no more than 5 feet tall, entirely bald, his head the shape and color of a huge hazelnut, his hands the size of skillets, only harder. He was possibly the sweetest human being I've ever met. He had no teeth left, and a seraphic half-smile parted his lips at all times. It wasn't the smile of an innocent or a fool of God. The serenity in his sharp old eyes had a sadness to it, as if it had been earned through a journey of suffering from which he had finally emerged at peace. It was spring. The great oak woods were full of bluebells, and the sky was bright, the light dazzling because the grey-green leaf clusters were still forming. Frère Louis gave me a heavy, curved old French hatchet, and smilingly, in patient mime, showed me how to cut unwanted saplings with one diagonal blow, as near to the ground as possible. He cut through one as if it were a nettle, and handed me the tool. I tried a sapling of roughly the same diameter, and barely nicked the bark. Frère Louis had turned away, either because one lesson was sufficient, or because he was too charitable to observe my pathetic woodsmanship. Bent almost double, the tiny nut-brown monk moved steadily between the oaks, amputating with one blow saplings twice the size of the one he'd demonstrated on. When the hatchet went clean through the trunk, it made a dull but distinct clang. I started on smaller wood, not much more than twigs, and slowly got the hang of it, working my way up to saplings of a worthy size. The two of us, a difference of 60 or 70 years between us, worked without a word through the stately woods for the next 2 hours. The steady clang of his hatchet and the occasional clang of mine are only communication. At noon, the abbey bells rang, and he straightened up and bowed his head. I realized he was saying the Angelus, that most ancient of agricultural customs, said in the fields at noon on every farm in every Catholic country for more than 1,000 years. I bowed my head and followed suit, happy, at peace, almost a monk. Almost. And almost 16. I was no longer just a visitor. I was a supplicant. I wanted in. Father Joe became oddly hard of hearing on the subject. "I'll be 16 in July, you know." It was the last day of my stay. We were strolling through the woods. "Father Joe? I was just admiring your handiwork, dear. What a wonderful job you've done." Frère Louis cut 10 to every one of mine, and mine were all tiddly. "Oh, I'm sure you're being modest, dear. Now, every time I walk in the woods, I shall have this to remind me of you." "What if I just stayed?"
"For once, you can see the bluebells."
"Father Joe, I believe you're avoiding the subject."
"Am I, dear? Well, I shall have to pay more attention."
"You were only 16 when you started thinking about entering Farnborough. You told me so yourself. So why not me?"
I wasn't as clever as you, dear. I was a dunce. I still am. Everyone says so."
"In July I'll have done my O-levels and I can leave school." O, for ordinary levels, were obligatory nationwide exams taken at age 16 in a variety of subjects. I was on firm ground here. Boys often entered seminaries after their O-levels.
"Yes, but then there are A-levels."
"Advanced levels, taken at 18.
"And, of course, university."
"I don't want to take A-levels, Father Joe. And why would I risk my immortal soul at university? And that's 3 years from now. If I entered this year, I could have taken my final vows by then and be a full member of the community." Father Joe stopped and plucked a bluebell. He was unusually reticent. Before the bluebell became his only focus, a distinct danger, concessions were needed. "Of course, if the community felt I should go to university, I would submit to anything required of me. After all, I would have taken a vow of obedience. But surely that would be best after I've taken my vows." He said nothing, but neither did he go into raptures about the bluebell. We walked on. Away on the hill, the abbey bells rang for vespers. He turned to me and took my hands.
"Dear Tony, your enthusiasm is infectious and precious. I don't think it's likely that the prior will allow you to enter now, but I will mention your wishes to him, and when you come next, the three of us can discuss it." "Father Joe, thank you. Thank you. God bless you."
I hugged him tight. He hugged me back, and we hurried up to vespers. For me, this was tantamount to welcoming me with open arms. I went home on a cloud. I would get through my O-levels. Then I had the 2 long months of summer holidays to convince everyone, my parents, Father Joe, the prior, the abbot, the pope if necessary, that St. Albans School and all its works were a meaningless bauble compared to my monastic vocation, my future as a saint. This had been the best year of my life, a year of clarity, of certainty, a year shot through with light. The light had refracted into every part of my world, transforming it. Yet so solid was the structure of my belief, it seemed less a transformation than an inevitable outcome. Long dead were vague ambitions to become a scientist of some sort, mostly driven by the dream of a salary more reliable than my dad's. My consuming interests now were history, literature, philosophy, arts, and above all, theology. What had once been conflicts seemed mere intellectual exercises. What had once seemed like pleasures now seemed hollow and petty. What had once been duties were now pleasures. Which is how I came to be serving Mass for our poor, broken parish priest on a sunny June morning in 1957. The Mass was nearly over now, and I was taking communion, mouth stretched wide open, tongue extended as far as possible. Thanks to those whisky hands, his aim with the host was not good. O-levels were behind me, and they'd been a breeze. I had a few more weeks of school, then core would be my only goal. I knew who I was and what I was going to be, and that it was not a finite career path, with a bell curve of promise, ambition, disappointment, pension. My path was a life free of grubbing after money and ridiculous, unfulfilling possessions, a life of pure thought and contemplation and self-betterment and divine rewards. I had a world-class tutor, and I was ready to get started, to become a spiritual champion, bouncing on the balls of my spiritual feet, with energy and skill for anything. That very same night, a late spring night, warm and balmy, a few weeks before my 16th birthday, the bottom fell out of my universe. Chapter 7. I slept in a room with my kid brother. He had the top bunk, I the bottom. He went to bed long before I did, but I didn't want any sibling knowing too much about my private affairs. In this case, that it was my custom to recite the office of Compline before I went to bed. Even for an 8-year-old kid, perhaps especially for an 8-year-old kid, this would have been irresistible ammunition. I performed my oblations silently, by flashlight. The best part of Compline is the final hymn to the Virgin, which changes throughout the year, but in late May is a gem from the 11th century called Salve Regina, Hail, O Queen. As it happened, Father Joe's favorite, which I knew by heart. I would have preferred to sing it aloud, but instead would kneel by my bed and sing it in my head, eyes shut tight, imagining myself in the darkened choir at core, surrounded by the men of peace in whose company I so longed to live. On this night, I put out the flashlight, knelt and sang the song as usual. Then I stayed kneeling for a few moments, imagining the young novice in the Abbey Church, turning out the lights, and my future brothers heading for their cells. Now the church was empty, pitch black, except for the far-off red light of the sanctuary. Suddenly, though it was a warm night, there was a chill in the bedroom, and in my heart a surge of cold animal fear that some vast, irresistible force was circling me, stalking me, about to pounce. Instinctively I prayed for strength or protection when, just as suddenly, I was falling in an elevator with its cables severed, accelerating down into the blackness of the shaft. I opened my eyes, but I was still falling, faster now, plunging into a chasm with no bottom, its dark sides rushing by me, and I knew, even as I fell, that my faith was being torn from me by the slipstream of my descent, as if I'd been flung from the battlements of my certainty. I squeezed my eyes shut, trying somehow to break the descent, praying desperately, "Please, God, help me, slow me, grant me a miracle." But there was no help or miracle, and I was hurtling still farther into the depths, both down there and above, watching myself fall as one does in a nightmare, falling through myself, out of my own soul, which never existed anyway, incalculable distances, below the solid rocks of faith and truth, into fathomless, cold, dead space, an infinity and eternity deep, where there was no God, nor Christ, nor faith, nor hope, nor certainty, nor salvation, and never would be ever again. I had stopped falling. I opened my eyes again. I was in my small room, I could hear my little brother breathing. It had been no nightmare. The terror, the agony of loss inside me, the utter desolation were real, cold, hard. I was sweating and trembling. My cheeks were wet. I threw every ounce of mental effort into waking myself up, in case this was one of those nightmares within a nightmare, where you wake from waking. But no. I was awake, and this was reality. The new reality of nothing. And worse, of having to continue to exist. A terrifying word came into my mind, like an echo running round a dark valley. Despair. You have despaired. You are damned. For despair is the unforgivable sin. I begged the darkness to give me back my faith, but the darkness said nothing. There was no one there to give it back. To pray to nothing for faith in nothing was a closed circle, and I was trapped inside it, its prisoner for all time. I was utterly alone. I had never felt such loneliness, to be existentially alone, alone in my existence. So nightmarish was the feeling that I wasn't even sure I did exist, which threw me into an even greater panic. Logic intervened. I had to exist to be able to ask the question, do I exist? But this took me even farther down, reminding me that my existence stretched before me and beyond death into the afterlife. An eternity of inescapable existence, circumscribed by God's non-existence, incarcerated without parole in the prison of self. Whoever or whatever had stolen my eternal freedom had also stolen my dreams of becoming a monk. They too had shattered in the fall. The shards were already drifting away into the trackless wastes of space, too distant to retrieve. And that loss was immediate and wrenching, as if I had seen a lover killed in front of me, vibrantly alive and present one second, dead and silent the next. Who was it that had committed this vicious, senseless act? Was it me? Was I guilty of my own destruction? I don't know how long I knelt there, my brother's peaceful little body making a bulge in the bedspring above me, as I swung between wild panic and utter mental paralysis. But suddenly there was sunlight in my eyes. It was morning. I had fallen asleep on my knees. My brother's bunk was empty, and Mum was yelling up the stairs. The pain and loss returned instantly, hit me like a hammer in the head. So did the realization that I'd woken an hour late for school. The universe may have been without God or hope or faith, but it definitely contained a bulbous green bus belching smoke through the tranquil lanes of Hertfordshire and due to arrive in the village 3/4 of a mile away in exactly 12 minutes. I washed, dressed, grabbed my things, and sprinted. The cliché that mindless activity takes your mind off misery is a lie. I sat in the bus, surrounded by cigarette smoke and giggling pink girls in grey uniforms, lost in an internal battle to the death. On one side, me and my will holed up in my head, outside it besieging forces of jeering, sneering, heavily armed doubts. Gone were the existential agonies of the night. Now specific propositions were being fired at me like rockets. God does not exist, therefore Christ was not God. Christ was a fool who got himself killed for nothing. Christ was a phony, a 2-bit snake oil salesman. There were endless Christ rockets. Throughout the half-hour bus trip, the battle raged on, as I forced the incoming doubts from my mind, grunting, no, 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 shaking my head, clenching my fists. My seatmate, a buxom matron in a sensible coat, a feathery 40s hat glued to the side of her perm, must have been aware of the quivering, muttering teen next to her, but when I took a quick breather from the battle to see where the bus was, she just stared politely ahead, a frozen smile on her lips. Not nice to notice the mentally ill, is it? Can't help themselves, poor things. A sumptuous late spring morning rolled past the bus window, the countryside a foaming ocean of white from the flowering hawthorns. the air swirling with intoxicated birds, sticky buds spreading into blossoms everywhere, stately white cloud galleons sailing through blue skies. There's no green to match the green that England turns in the spring, the nuclear explosion of its flora, the exquisite balance between the decorum of the countryside and the joyful chaos of rebirth. In springtime, England lets go its dank irony and murky ambiguity and rain-soaked rancor. The green and pleasant land bursts with uncomplicated energy. But I had only one thought as I rolled through all the new life. I could not afford to die. In this now hostile, lethally unpredictable world, my actual demise was just as possible as the recent demise of everything I believed in. And death would mean damnation. By the time I made it to school, I was exhausted. You can't wage war against the massed armies of doubt and despair on 2 hours' sleep and an empty stomach. My class was in rollicking spirits. With the summer holidays in sight and the dread O-levels behind us, 5 long years of work had wound to its end. What remained of school was without much discipline and light on homework. Everyone was high as a kite, as I had been just 24 hours earlier. Now I oscillated between contempt for my pals' worldliness and shallowness and inanity, and envy that I couldn't participate ever again in their worldly, shallow inanities. I couldn't dislodge the image of myself, a healthy, athletic teen with no history of serious illness, suddenly keeling over and croaking. Lying there, rasping my last shallow breaths, begging the concerned Protestant faces for a priest, who, even if he came in time, couldn't absolve me. I remembered something I'd not paid much attention to when it happened a year before. A boy in my class had died suddenly while playing rugby. He had run the length of the field, scored a try, and collapsed dead. He'd had a rare lung condition, but had never had the slightest symptom. Back then, he had seemed more a curiosity than anything, that unfortunate member of almost every student body. Now, his death confirmed for me the intense fragility of life. That day, there was a swimming match against another school. As vice-captain of the swimming team, I couldn't avoid it, but I dreaded it. The pool seemed the perfect setting for some untoward fatality. The other school had a hopeless team, chubby, pear-shaped lads, who looked as if they'd been chosen on the rationale that when they dived in, at least they wouldn't sink. I was considered a shoo-in in my event, the 100-yard breaststroke. But in the lead, halfway down the second lap, I suffered a particularly violent assault on the doctrine of the real presence, closed my eyes with the effort of repelling it, and slammed into the end of the pool. A boy twice my weight floundered to easy victory. The bus ride home was even worse than the one in the morning. The assaults had abated somewhat, only to be replaced by a depression so profound and all-encompassing and inescapable, it hurt. I trudged home from school through the blossoming hedgerows and past our little church. It had always been a warm place, reliable in its unassuming smallness, a fixed point in my daily world. Yesterday, I had ducked in, as I always did, for a quick word with the Blessed Sacrament. But now? In my year of light, the real presence had been one of my most glorious discoveries, the most immediate point of contact with the divine. I not only believed in the doctrine, in front of the tabernacle, I felt the imminence of a being I believed to be Jesus, as I felt that presence nowhere else. The presence was not of a person exactly. It was somehow impersonal or suprapersonal, beyond the confines of human personality, yet unmistakably there, filling the church. Sometimes, when I became lost in prayer, the presence was so vivid and real that I almost had to run from the church before it overpowered me. Today the little church looked ugly and rickety, a place where danger lurked. What new nightmare awaited me inside? Nothing awaited me. Nothing hovered over the tabernacle like a dark cloud. Nothing sat on the altar like a pile of luggage, packed and ready to leave. Nothing glared at me triumphantly from the rafters, the pulpit, the pews, the communion rail. The church was a void, gray and cold. What was to become of me? Where could I turn? My parents would be no help. Father Bleary, right now pouring his first whiskey of the evening in the rectory, even less. Ben and Lily were out. There was only one person who could help me, and he was far away, 4 or 5 hours' journey at least, and it was already 6 in the evening. But it had to be done. My parents would be frantic, but what choice did I have? I turned back toward the bus stop. An express bus to St. Albans arrived, a good omen. In the early evening there were plenty of trains to London. I had just about enough cash. I was on my way to help. But the journey was another nightmare. The hordes had developed a whole new generation of deadlier, more precisely targeted weapons. What if Father Joe was not what I'd always thought, the rock on which I'd built my church, but the cartoon he looked like, a holy clown in a black dress? How would Cor seem when I got there? Home? Or an asylum for other holy clowns? Time slowed to a crawl. Each leg of the trip, once so full of delicious, time-gobbling feelings, was interminable. My enemies seemed to have control of time itself, the ability to slow it down to nothing. One moment stood out. I had to change at a tube station in the West End, which was packed with theatergoers, forcing me to the very edge of the platform. The train hurtled into the station. The center rail, with its pit beneath, seemed to quiver like a great silver serpent. Not long before, Mum had told me that my dad's father had committed suicide. I'd been horrified, since it meant my grandpa was in hell, but also fascinated that anyone could get to a point so distant from hope, a situation so without remedy, that the only release would be to murder yourself. But now I understood. I was surely in the same place my grandpa must have been, a prison cell with no door, a place from which no one could rescue me. Suicide was not an option. It would mean damnation. But since I was damned anyway for my despair, what was the difference? At least this racking mental and physical misery would end. A detail of my grandfather's suicide, on which my mother had dwelt with the vindictive relish of an unsympathetic daughter-in-law, was this. Grandma always maintained that Grandpa had killed himself by jumping in front of an underground train, but in fact, he'd hanged himself in the cellar. According to the finely calibrated values of the lower middle class by which my grandma lived, death by underground was evidently a finer and nobler end than topping yourself. For me, in that moment, it made perfect sense. Jumping off a chair and hoping the rope would break your neck was fraught with the risk of living. Here, all you had to do was fall forward and you were gone, smashed and ground beyond recognition, a zillion volts flooding through the remains, just in case. Do it. Fall forward. Embrace that silver snake. It'll all be over. Come on. Only a fraction of a second left. Decide. But I didn't decide. Not to, that is. I simply hesitated long enough. Then the train was past me slowing, and the moment had been absorbed into the interpretable past. A whole new front into which the hordes rushed to fill up with their willing dead. For hadn't I intended to commit the act, but been saved by circumstance? Intention being equal to the sin, I was now guilty not just of despair, the unforgivable sin, but of suicide, the unabsolvable sin. I squeezed into the crowded carriage, hot and close, my skin clammy cold from my brush with death and damnation. This was hell, nor was I out of it. I'd never come to Cor at night. It was past 11, several hours after Compline. The driveway was pitch black as I trudged up it, the mass of the monastery completely dark, unreadable to a heart yearning for comfort. The place was so still, it could have been peopled only with ghosts. No movement anywhere except a speeding moon in the treetops, behind scudding clouds. And there I was, the traveller, knocking on the moonlit door. Nothing. I knocked again. Still nothing. I hesitated to ring the bell, having no idea where it sounded, or to whom, or how loudly. But I'd come halfway across the south of England, and I'd lost my faith. Almost immediately after I pressed the bell, a window opened above me. A testy voice said three times, "Who is it? Who is it? Who is it?" It was the old monk of my first visit, whom I'd never seen again. He peered down at me, peering up. "Why, Tony," he said, surprising me no end. "It's you." He disappeared. Bolts scraped, and he reappeared, swinging back the big guest house door. "Come in, come in. Whatever's the matter, boy?" I couldn't explain. There was just too much to say. Too many words were needed. "Please, may I stay the night?" He squinted at me, puzzled but concerned through his battered glasses. All testiness gone. "Of course you may. I think number four has been made up. If you don't mind, I..." "May I see Father Joseph?" He went to say no, or to remind me of the hour, but nothing came out. He sighed a little at the unorthodoxy of it all, the stairs that had to be climbed. "I'll see what I can do." I hauled myself up the creaky guest-house steps, down the drab corridor to number four, and sank on the bed. I was still twitching and gritting, but it was a reflex. There was a lull in the attacks. The horde seemed less sure of themselves here. Time passed. Too much time, I thought, if he was coming. I could not afford to sleep. I was shell-shocked, weary and wary. I had to stay awake. A door opened far away. Slow steps mounted distant stairs. My heart sank. It was the old monk for sure. Father Joe was not coming. I would have to endure the night then. Across the space between us, I could feel the dark armies stirring. Oh, God, no, here they come. "Tony, dear, wake up." And there was the long face, twitching and blinking as ever, glasses askew, for once not smiling. The collarless neck of an old-fashioned nightshirt trapped by his hastily donned robe. He squatted in front of me, holding my hands as I sat on the bed, waking. You're upset, dear. What is it?" The tears exploded, all 24 hours' worth. I tried, gasping, sobbing, to explain that I'd lost my faith, that I had despaired. I'd committed the unforgivable sin, and soon it was not grief that was making me incoherent, but relief. Overwhelming relief that he was not a cartoon or a holy clown in a black dress, but a great rock, a calm harbor, a sheltering wing, my Father Joe. He did nothing but listen. He made no attempt to calm me or cool the heat of this new development in the insane life of this insane child. He didn't try to explain why I was feeling these things, why what seemed so catastrophic was actually normal, common for my age, simply the result of the hormones raging through my plumbing. He didn't try to shock me out of my funk or manhandle me for my own good with tough love. He called down no higher powers to intercede on my behalf, nor did he invite me to join him in prayer. He didn't do anything that would have said, "This is not as bad as you think." He took my condition head on, as seriously as I took it. Tomorrow there might be other responses, the intellectual consequences of what I was saying to be dealt with. But not tonight. Tonight there was just a desperate boy on a cold and lonely cinder spinning through a meaningless universe, who'd come running across the home counties in a waking nightmare, convinced that it was all somehow his fault. He did say one thing, after I'd cried myself out and sat there heaving and shuddering with fatigue and gratitude. "There is no such thing as an unforgivable sin, Tony dear. God forgives anything and everything." He made me take off my jacket and shoes and get into bed. He sat beside the bed and pulled the blankets up to my chin and put his warm hand on my brow. The gentle force that I remembered flowing into me at our very first meeting flowed into me now, filling cold and empty places. How long he sat there, I have no idea. 2 minutes? 2 hours? Peace descended like snowflakes. My terror receded until it was far out to sea. The dark hordes were nowhere to be seen. Sweet oblivion came, and I slept. Chapter 8.
No, dear, I'm afraid it was not the dark night of the soul.
We were sitting on a log on our promontory by the sea. It was the middle of the next morning. Back at St. Albans, my classmates were heaving school supplies at each other behind Monsieur Garnier's prim French back. A few days before, I'd started reading the poems of St. John of the Cross. It was a long shot, but I was hoping my great tribulation might have leapfrogged me into the major leagues, the youngest inductee ever into the Mystics' Hall of Fame.
"The dark night of the soul comes only after years of discipline and meditation. It's the last stage, the final test, before the soul achieves perfect union with God."
"Have you experienced the dark night of the soul?"
"So far, dear, I have not been that lucky."
I had woken, hours after the rest of the community, from a deep sleep. Calm and relaxed, but with a dull, all-body pain, as if during the night I'd undergone major emergency surgery. At first I couldn't remember the reason. Then gradually it came back. The crash, the aftermath, the miracle doctor who'd put me back together. I would live. Terribly disfigured, but I would live.
You fell in love with God, you see, and now the romantic part is over. It happens to us all, I'm afraid.
I'll never have that feeling of light and certainty again.
Someday you'll experience a much greater light and certainty than just feelings.
Feelings are not good?
Feelings are a great gift, but they're treacherous, if that's all we live for. They drive us back into ourselves, you see. What I want, what I feel, what I need. A man and a woman pass beyond just feelings at some point, don't they? That's when they start to know true love. The love of another. The joy in another's existence. The wonderful ways that the other person is not like you, nor you like them. What you said about the prison of self you felt you were in, that was very exact. Love releases you from that prison, you see.
He'd arrived in number 4 as I was washing my one pair of socks, with a cup of tea and a pile of toast. The night before, he'd sat with me for a while to make sure I was sound asleep, then called my parents before going back to bed. It had been midnight, and they were a bit worried, but not too much. They figured I was down at the Bootles.
On our customary walk, he said he had a little quiz for me. He made me repeat all my inner battles, item by item, literally quizzing me, neatly dissecting the answers to refute my loss of faith. My agonizing over the unforgivable sin, for instance, showed I clearly still believed in God. Otherwise, why would I have cared about being unforgiven? Conversely, it also meant I still believed in the forgiveness of sins. Worrying about my intentional sin of suicide meant I still believed in damnation and therefore the afterlife. And since I hadn't hurried off to some atheist for answers, but to a Catholic monastery, I probably still believed a little in the Church's teachings. That was half the Apostles' Creed right there. This was a new Father Joe, more authoritative, more analytical and definitive, a little more severe, a docent even, but nothing like this had ever come out of Ben.
Feelings trap us in the self, Tony dear. Doing a thing because you feel wonderful about it, even a work of charity, is in the end a selfish act. We perform the work not to feel wonderful, but to know and love the other. It's the same with your romance. You may not feel your love, but God is still your loved one, your other.
I can't get over the feeling that there's no one there.
God is there, dear. God is here now, with us.
For that moment, anyway, it seemed undeniable. I began to sense that there might be possibilities I could never have known while my world was overflowing with feelings of boundless possibility. Another level of belief, another kind of light, a profounder certainty.
The other day, Father Pryor was telling me about a French writer, Jean-Paul Sartre, an existentialist. I'm sure a brain like you has come across him. One phrase of his particularly struck me. L'enfer, c'est les autres. Do you think he meant that as a joke?
I don't think humour's a strong point with existentialists.
I think it's poppycock. How can hell be others? God is manifested in others. God is the other. That's why the self must lose itself in love for the other. It's the self we must leave behind. Better to say, hell is the self. L'enfer, c'est moi.
L'enfer, c'est les sartres, I said.
Oui, oui, oui. Though an unfair to the rest of the sartres.
The seagulls swooped over the rolling breakers, eyeing their lunch. A momentary squall blew by, spewing rain on us. Neither of us moved. There was that little lull that comes after laughter. I was feeling nothing, but peace suffused me. So peace was not a feeling. Peace was less centered on self, less substantive. Like a force in physics, perhaps, a force that could only flow between you and another you, between two molecules called me. As it seemed to flow now from Father Joe to me, and as far as I could tell, from me back to him. Define peace, Father Joe.
Peace is love, dear, and love, peace. Peace is the certainty that you are never alone.
I had not thought about my doubts, my problems, my anguish all day. It was not just Father Joe's logical demonstration that the damage I'd suffered was less than I thought. That was reassuring, but the desolation and loss were still throbbing like a fresh wound. Rather, it was his dramatic otherness that I trusted. I might have lost my faith, but I could still believe that he was, to me, and for the moment, God. God the other. He didn't sound like God as I had ever conceived the term, but what else could it be? Love was a possibility, but that didn't fit any of my existing definitional templates either. Unless peace, love, and God were all in some way the same thing.
God gave you a great gift that terrible night, Tony dear. He gave you a vision of hell, not that silly fire and brimstone stuff. True hell. Being alone with yourself for all eternity. Only your own self to hope in. Only your own self to love. In secula seculorum. As you said, a prison with no door. I don't think that vision will ever come to you again. You must never forget it.
He was right, as usual. It never did. And I never did. He made me go home the next day. I climbed the bus steps to the top deck to get a longer view of the gnome cap minaret as it slipped away through the oaks, and remembered what he had said in those far-off days when everything seemed clear and simple. On the next visit, we would discuss whether I could enter Corps that summer. This had been that visit. It had never been mentioned. Yet in a way, it was academic. Once again, I had come thinking I wanted one thing, and left having discovered something quite different. Father Joe had been right. I had not been ready to enter the novitiate. I had been too innocent, too untried. My descent into hell had forced me to consider the deeper nature of what I professed to believe, the life I wished to choose. For a year, I'd basked in my faith as if it were no more my responsibility than a fine spell of weather. Now I had to fight for it, dig deeper foundations, prove how much it meant to me. Thinking I'd been engulfed by darkness, instead I'd found enlightenment and strength of purpose. The way ahead would be a steeper, stonier path that led to grimmer, tougher places. The real world, hard issues, life as it was really lived. There would be more tests, more doubts. But doubts were normal, even to be embraced. By questioning where you stood, you moved forward. I knew now, beyond any doubt, that this abbey was where I belonged. That in this community, not, after all, a choir of black-robed angels, but real men, others to whom and from whom flowed that quiet, mysterious peace I had experienced. I would spend the rest of my days. Chapter 9. Back home, I was a stranger in the door. It was a Saturday evening, and my father was out in the garden. Mum was beside herself with rage. At first, I thought it was the running away, which I apologized for copiously. But as she raved on, I saw that the episode, as she called it, had brought home to her the hold Cora had on me, and that someday soon I was going to enter it and be lost to her. Isn't a Catholic mother supposed to be proud to give a son to the church?
If you want to be a priest, that's one thing. But these pansies, chanting and making pottery and honey and whatnot, that isn't Catholicism.
Of course it is. The Benedictines are the oldest order.
Escapism. That's what it is, running away from reality.
No, discovering true reality, a life of prayer. And
why can't you do something useful? After all the sacrifices we've made, just you wait till your father gets here.
On cue, my father entered. He took one look and knew what was going on. His face was grim.
Robert, you must put your foot down once and for all about this monk rubbish.
Dad went over to the laundry cupboard and opened the door. In here, please, Anthony.
This couldn't be happening.
The laundry cupboard, where the laundry dried, was actually a tiny boiler room. In times gone by, it was here he'd take me for punishment. For most infractions, a boxing of the cranial region. For capital crimes, a tanning with something made of leather. I hadn't been in the laundry cupboard for years. He shoved me in and closed the door behind us. I was much bigger than last time, and I floundered in the laundry. I turned toward him, just as he turned toward me, and flung up an arm instinctively to ward off the blow. But there was no blow. In fact, he flinched, as though I were going to hit him. It was the first time I'd ever seen him flinch. I was a good inch taller than he was now, broad-shouldered and trim from track and swimming. He was out of shape, with thinning hair and a thickening waistline. In the long moment he took to recover himself, to pretend he hadn't acknowledged his weakness, he seemed literally to shrink, as if I were looking at him through the wrong end of a telescope, his head tiny, far away down there below. The head said, "I didn't bring you in here for the usual reason. It was to say something private I don't want your mother to hear. I don't mind what you do with your life. Do what you want, not what others want. I did. But don't hurt her, and you must finish your schooling. Is that clear?" His head was the right size again. I nodded mine. From that moment on, we never had another fight. Even before this, I'd thought that there was finally some chance of a relationship with my dad. A month earlier, I'd announced that I wouldn't be going into science sixth form after all, but would be heading over to the arts side. Mum was deeply dismayed. Perhaps she hoped I'd be the ticket to a degree of prosperity. I think she hated being married to an artist, living from stained glass window to stained glass window, with no fridge, no television, and a very used car every year or so that broke down within weeks. Dad would buy these with at least 40,000 miles on them, a huge mileage in pre-motorway Britain, and though he'd been trained as an engineer in the RAF, he had no talent for car repair. Since he also refused to buy American, we became victims of superlative British workmanship. The home counties were littered with the corpses of our Morrises, Austins, and Vauxhalls. Mum did have compensations, like getting to meet dignitaries at the unveiling of new windows. Usually these were fat churchmen or sozzled minor nobility. At the Westminster Abbey do, she actually got to shake the hand of the charming young Duke of Edinburgh, who, though sozzled, was not fat. But these occasions were infrequent. It takes several years to get a window from sketches to a hole in a church wall. And anyway, none of them translated into a fridge. I suspected that Dad, officially in accord with her about my artsy-fartsy plans and coming lifelong penury, was secretly delighted, and that my monastic dreams, far from offending his agnostic sensibilities, tickled them. He wasn't a mere artist, after all, but an artisan in an ancient craft. He set great stock in mixing his paint from the antique pigments his forerunners had used in the 13th and 14th centuries, which gave his glass intense, evocative colours. His windows had a certain authenticity from the traditional techniques of leading and aciding and firing he also insisted on. Forward-looking socialist he might be, for him, medieval was not a dirty word. Greater communication between us revealed how private and saddened a man he was. Our alienation hadn't been of his making, but of Hitler's. His reaction to the ghastly landscape created by the Cold War generals was not very different from mine. The Age of Faith may not have been perfect, but those benighted centuries had been a sight more civilized than this one. I don't mean we had an easy time of it. He was weak and had a foul temper, and he cheated on my mother. But one thing remained rock solid. I was deeply proud of what he had chosen to do with his life. That summer I went to France for the first time, on a bicycle tour of Normandy and Brittany, with a school friend, Michael Church. Michael's last name was odd, because his dad was a C of E vicar, the Reverend Church. He was a gentle, patient guy, of a somewhat spiritual bent himself, who shared my new literary enthusiasms and would put up with my occasional religiosity. He also shared my passion for churches, at least the great cathedrals of northern France. If he tired of having to stop in every other village to check out its nondescript place of worship, he was too polite to say so. I couldn't get enough of them. I'd never been in a Catholic country before, and this hard evidence of the Church's transnational reach and cultural depth gave me a reassuring sense of belonging, not something I'd often felt in England. I told my parents the fib that we'd be in France for 3 weeks or more. Actually, we were there about a fortnight, so I had almost a week to spend at Caen. There was no more playing at monk. I wanted to get as much training as I could in my chosen profession before actually entering the monastery. I stayed on the third floor of the guesthouse, which seemed to be the preferred spot for those interested in entering the monastery, and I regularly worked on the farm or on the grounds. I also started to get occasional instruction from the prior, a formidable scholar and historian named Dom Aelred Sillim. Other people found Dom Aelred a cold fish, but he filled a cerebral need I was feeling. His large and unforgiving intellect could grapple with formal questions of philosophy or theology, which Father Joe tended to deflect. As I got to know him better, I found that he also had an intense mystical core, in sharp contrast to Father Joe's down-to-earth saintliness. He came from a distinguished German family, with origins in Hamburg, and had entered the Benedictine order at the Abbey of Downside. Dom Aelred and several other monks, including the celebrated historian Dom David Knowles, grew unhappy with the worldliness of Downside, whose rich and prestigious public school had many secular liaisons, and began agitating for a new foundation which would live by a contemplative and far stricter interpretation of the rule. They failed in this goal, and Dom Aelred came to Caen. He was a severe and ascetic man who believed in the virtues of order and discipline, and could hardly have been more different from Father Joe. As the most prominent younger men in the community, its future leaders, they nonetheless complemented each other beautifully. Dom Aelred and Father Joe were the head and the heart of Caen, a monastic odd couple, one living by logic and precedent, the other by emotion and intuition. The two were a real-life version of Ben and Lily's Franco-Prussian fantasy, a man with actual Teutonic roots, and one who, if not French, had spent almost two-thirds of his life speaking, thinking, and breathing French. They represented the extremes of the Benedictine spectrum. At one end, the ultraviolet of awe and order, at the other, the infrared of love and community. Dom Aelred held that the fear of God led to the love of God. Father Joe never tired of telling me, "We have to take the fear out of religion, dear." I never spent an hour with Dom Aelred that didn't leave me feeling I'd been through an intellectual car wash. It was with Father Joe that I felt safe. It was as natural as air to call Dom Joseph Warrilow Father Joe. It would have been unthinkable to call Dom Aelred Sillim Father Ale. Dom Aelred sent me home that summer with a reading list for Mysticism 101. Among others, Thomas A. Kempis, Dame Julian of Norwich, the anonymous author of The Cloud of Unknowing, St. Teresa of Avila, and her Franciscan mentor, Bernardino de Laredo, who wrote a how-to of mystical advancement called The Ascent of Mount Sion, which St. Teresa swore by. He also suggested that when I had time, I should dip into the Desert Fathers, the dour, unyielding pillars of the early church. I found Thomas A. Kempis pedestrian, but Dame Julian beguiling. I was surprised by the Spaniards, whom I expected to be intense and passionate like St. John of the Cross. Instead, I found them ferocious and absolute, their paths to salvation painstakingly laid out in dozens of steps and stages, with spiritual exercises to get you from one to the next, and crammed with gloomy imagery minutely worked out. The great door of grace might be opened with the doorknob of constant prayer on the hinges of relentless self-denial. Or they would casually throw out daunting tidbits of information. The ascent of Mount Sion estimated that the path to perfection, from a standing start to union with the Godhead, takes 30 years. If you make it. No guarantee that at the end of year 29, within sight of the summit, you won't choke and slide back down to base camp. In my 16-year-old hunger for learning and experience, I lapped it all up. In the back of my mind, though, was the hope that somewhere, in all this strenuous and often inspiring piety, would be one story or account or prayer or insight that would somehow spark a fiery and emotional renewal of my lost Eden, wipe out the ravages of my night in hell. Sensing that there was probably something aberrant about this, I mentioned it to Father Joe.
Well, dear, the whole point of the mystical path to God is that it's arduous. That's why it's often called the way of the cross. It takes years of dedication, hard work, and discipline, with few rewards. There are no shortcuts. Certainly not the coup de foudre you're looking for. We leave that to the holy rollers. The trouble with being a holy roller is, it's wonderful at the time, but what do you do the next day? And the day after that?
Father Joe's favourite writers were those who inspired rather than systematised. Dame Julian he loved, and the Cloud of Unknowing. As for Thomas a Kempis, whose Imitation of Christ, written in the late 1400s, is one of the best-known devotional texts of the Church,
it's very sound, solid stuff. But don't you think, dear, that Brother Thomas must have been a most uninteresting person to be with?
This had been exactly my reaction, but I would never have dared express it to Dom Ilred. He'd have bored me silly.
Of course, he did spend most of his life in Holland. That might have something to do with it.
Of the Spanish mystical contortionists,
dear me, no. I could never remember all those steps and exercises, like learning to be a chartered accountant.
And of the august and adamantine desert fathers,
stay away from them, silly old devils.
Father Joe responded to the person, to the simplicity and limpidity of the writing, rather than to the degree of order which could be imposed on the volcanic and mysterious process of salvation. This may have been why he suggested the pithy, punchy, and passionate 13th-century German Meister Eckhart, a brilliant preacher considered by Protestant scholars to be an early precursor of the Reformation. Dom Aylred had specifically forbidden me to read him until much later, because he was difficult. I loved Meister Eckhart. When God laughs at the soul, and the soul laughs back at God, the persons of the Trinity are begotten. When the Father laughs at the Son, and the Son laughs back at the Father, that laughter gives pleasure, that pleasure gives joy, that joy gives love, and that love